Welcome to the Bruce City Church Podcast. We are a Christian church following in the way of Jesus and located in the heart of downtown Milwaukee. We're glad you've joined us and we hope you enjoy this week's message.
Hey everyone. Good to see you. Good morning. Let me just put a little PS, a postscript on one of those announcements, the baptism stuff. August 24th, if you haven't been baptized and you follow Jesus and you love Jesus and you call yourself a Christian, I would love to see you get baptized. Pastorally, it's just, I can't recommend it strongly enough, actually. Because baptism has been this practice and this tradition in the church since it began. And it's this, in the early church, they held baptism as this beautiful, symbolic, strong symbol that said, I'm renouncing all the other things in my life over and above, in putting Jesus over and above all the things in my life. I want to follow Jesus and I want to give myself to Jesus and I don't care who knows about it. And I want to say that's a beautiful thing to do in our faith journey. So whether you're 8 years old and you want to do that, or you're 78 years old and you want to do that, I just want to encourage you and invite you. I'd love, all you got to do is sign up at the QR code. You just scan that QR code. The name will get emailed to me, your name will get emailed to me, and I'll just reach out to you and we can have a conversation. Even if you're just thinking about it, I'd love to talk to you, all right? Let me just pray real quick before we do the sermon thing. God, I'm grateful for times like this. I'm grateful for this moment, this time right now with these friends, both in this room and online. I'm grateful for times and moments and places where I get to pause and think a little bit more deeply. I get to remember some things that are really important that I'm prone to forget. Like the great old hymn says, I'm prone to wander, and my heart is to you, Jesus. So would you remind us of, continue to remind us of things that are real and true. Continue to call us into more and more life and goodness and healing and hope. Continue to frame and reframe what it looks like to be human and to follow you, Jesus, in this world. In Jesus' name, amen. So we've been in this sermon series called Being Christian for, I don't know how long, months. And when we talk about being Christian, last week my friend Megan Westra talked about what it means to be a Christian woman. What it means to be a Christian woman. When you talk about what it means to be Christian, our gender matters, and in showing up as a Christian woman or a Christian man matters. And I want to talk about that and be honest about that and figure out how we can journey together and process these things together. But when you say things like, what does it mean to be a biblical man? Or what is biblical womanhood or biblical manhood look like? When you say those phrases, biblical manhood, biblical womanhood, we're talking about two phrases that, for some of us, cause us to throw up in our mouths a little bit. We're talking about two phrases that have been thrown around the church over and over again. If you are like me and you grew up in the church, particularly if you were like me and you grew up in the church in the 1980s and 90s and 2000s came of age, all that stuff, these two words, the biblical manhood and biblical womanhood, were phrases that were thrown around all the time. And we were given these assumptions about what it looks like to be a biblical man or a woman. I don't have tons of time, but I want to hear, let's think together. Tell me, what have you heard that it means to be a biblical man? What does biblical manhood look like according to what we've heard growing up in the church? Say that again. Head of the household is very, very, just like, bam, that's what it means to be a biblical man. It looks like you got to get married. You're the head of the household, provider for your family. A biblical man provides for his family. And if you don't, we got a lot of like charismatic and like boisterous preachers who tell you how much of a man you aren't if you're not providing for a family. So head of the family, provider, what else?
Protector.
A biblical man is a protector, right? What leader, Bob said, leader, Grace. The spiritual leader of the family, right? Initiator, okay, all right. And some of these are, I'm not sure if they're good or bad, or we've done things to them that would make them a little sus, right? But my daughter doesn't like it when I use kid terms. But they say them enough that I can't, my kids are looking at me like I'm in a crisis moment right now. We're just going to keep moving. I saw another hand over here. No? Did I just shut this whole situation down? Tracy. A rock. A man, a biblical man is the rock of his family, of this community. We need these rocks. What else? Anything else? Ooh, all right. A biblical woman. If you're walking in your biblical womanhood, you're going to submit to a man walking in his biblical manhood. Daniel, do you have some?
Has to be straight.
Time out. Thank you, Daniel, for giving me, like, I was just like, where do I put in this little kind of tidbit here? Because when I'm about to give a sermon, I'm about to give a sermon about what it means, what it might mean to be a biblical man, what it looks like to be a Christian man, being a Christian man. And when people like me in the church have talked about what it means to be a biblical man, it is completely assumed that I'm just talking to straight men. Because you can't be a biblical man if you're queer, is the assumption, right? Now, if you're new to this church, you're like, holy cow, they talk about some things here. But I'm just going to say this real quick. That's stupid.
Amen.
And it's not only stupid, but it's, first of all, it's not biblical. Second of all, it's got this really limited view of masculinity that is rooted in insecurity. So I just want to say real quick, I don't have tons of time to go into this, but I'm talking to all of you men. It doesn't matter your sexual orientation, your all this stuff that goes into it, that has nothing to do with masculinity and what it means to be a man. Time back in. Thank you, Daniel, for giving me that, allowing me to say that. Josh.
Be like Mark Driscoll.
Now we're getting real specific. Okay. I don't think I have time to go into that, but many of us think that these masculine, manly, angry pastors who have rips in their jeans and wear the right metallic bracelets and look manly and look really authoritarian and powerful and strong, that this is what it looks like to be a man. We'll find out, okay? We could go on and on, right? We could have a good time talking about what it looks like to be a Christian man or what we've been told biblical manhood is supposed to look like. But then, and we can have a good fun time joking about this stuff, but if we want to get real, I've heard for a little bit now, and I remember, I didn't believe this when I first heard it, but I've heard men in our culture are struggling. And in particular, young men in our culture, in our nation, are struggling. And then I've even heard that, in particular, young white males are struggling. And the first couple times I heard that, I was like, you must be joking, right? Now, that's the most male thing to do, is to like have all the power for all of history, and then the moment that you feel a little like equality moving towards the surface, now men are struggling. This is the way I responded to it. That's a funny joke. But turns out men, and in particular young men, are really struggling in our culture. Let me give you some statistics. Here's an education, just a couple of little sample things. Women graduate college at a significantly higher rate than men in every single state in America currently. 7 out of 10 high school valedictorians, my daughter just graduated high school, 7 out of 10 high school valedictorians are female. In the next 5 years, for every man who graduates college, we expect 2 female graduates. Now, these statistics are from an article by the Stanford Review, not some, you know, woman bashing, you know, anti-feminist movement. This is one of these liberal academic bastions that love to champion feminism, but they're telling us that in the next 5 years, for every male who graduates college, we can expect 2 female graduates. And the implications of this education gap that's becoming more and more wide is just, they tell us, the lifetime income of a college graduate is twice that of a non-degree holder, and college graduates are half as likely to be unemployed as those who have a high school diploma. And those things matter when we talk about men struggling with depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation. These things have a correlation, the experts tell us. So young men in America are falling behind in the education area and gap. Relationships, experts say there is a relationship recession primarily among men in our nation. In 1990, 55% of men said they had 6 or more close friends. I'm going to say that again. In 1990, about 35 years ago, holy moly, do I feel old saying that. Thank you, Marianne. In 1990, 55% of men said they had 6 or more relationships. In 2021, just 31 years later, that number dropped to 27% of men said they have 6 or more close friends. That's a half for the non-math majors here. 27% of men in 2021 say they have 6 or more close friends. The percentage of men who say they have no close friends has gone from 3% in 1990. So men who say, I have no close friends, if I'm honest, none. That number, the percent of men in 1990 who said they had no close friends was 3%. In 2021, 15% of men say they had no close friends. Again, for you non-math majors like me, that's 5 times the amount in 31 years. For those of us who have, if you're single, the data is worse. For single men, the data says that 1 in 5 single men report having no close friends. 1 in 5 single men have no close friends. If we get to the really serious stuff, young men are 3 times more likely than females to overdose on drugs or alcohol. Young men are 4 times more likely to commit suicide than females. Young men are 14 times more likely to be incarcerated than females. And 90% of all mass shooters are men. What we have is a reality of violence and addiction and undereducation and underemployment among men, and in particular young men in our culture. Men are struggling. Again, these statistics are not from some woman-hating publication. These are from the Stanford Review and Psychology Today, speaking urgently about the fact that men have a problem in our nation. And when we ask, how do we respond to this? There has been a response in our greater world, in our culture. And one of those responses has been this kind of reaction to what we find is from men retreating from the public world, is this reality that I've just been kind of researching a little bit called the manosphere. Has anybody heard of the manosphere? Maybe you haven't heard of it, but maybe you've interacted with it, I'm sure, in some ways. But there's this growing culture, what I would call a bro culture, especially online, where you have these very charismatic, very ripped, very confident, very, quote, scare quote, manly men, young men, who are alphas. Does this language ring a bell a little bit? Who are self-proclaimed alphas, who say all men are either alphas or betas, and that just means you're either strong, aggressive, angry, confident, or you're kind of this little feminist guy, little boy over here. All men are alphas and betas. We have this kind of version of masculinity that our young men are being told this is what it looks like to be a man, that is rooted in anger and in hatred and in bitterness and in violence. And there's, when you look into it, I can't imagine what my algorithm on my internet search history looks like right now, because I've been looking into this manosphere and I'm scared about my future now. But there are real names out there that are drawing the attention of thousands and thousands and thousands, millions of young men. Defining masculinity by saying really ugly things. And so I'm just going to say, I don't have time to go into this, but if your version of masculinity is misogynistic and hates females, hates women, I know this is going to get me in trouble for saying this word along with masculinity, but if that's your version of masculinity, it's toxic. If your version of masculinity is inherently homophobic and transphobic and relies on scapegoating communities that are marginalized already in our world, if your version of masculinity thrives on tearing those communities down, your version of masculinity is toxic. If your version of masculinity thrives on dominance and domination and aggressiveness and violence and anger and bitterness in general, it's toxic. Now, if that word toxic masculinity, if that phrase is triggering for you, let me just put this in a more traditional, old school way. If you're following people and listening to people who are trying to tell you, and you're believing this, that masculinity looks dominant and aggressive. And let me just say, like, who this is coming from. I love sports. I'm a former boxer, right? Like, when it comes to, like, defining yourself by your toughness, I'm a 3-time state champion in boxing. Like, this is who I am. If you would have asked me 30 years ago what you want to do, I would have said, I want to be welterweight champion of the world in boxing. That was my whole life. But I want to tell you, if your version of masculinity is angry or violent or rooted in domination and aggressiveness, your version of masculinity is just straight up sinful. Take the word toxic out of it if you want and replace it with sin. Because see, masculinity doesn't look like tearing other people and people groups down. There's got to be another way is what I want to say. There's got to be another way to respond to what seems to be a growing crisis for men in our nation. So what do we do and how do we respond? What's a better way? I want to just say I'm just going to take the cheat code this morning and just say there's one real easy answer for when we ask the question, what does it look like to be a Christian man in our world? We've got a cheat code. See, God's self became a person and just happened to become a man. So when you want to know what it looks like, what biblical manhood looks like, how about we just start looking at the man named Jesus? Let's just look at the man named Jesus for just a few minutes this morning and see how masculinity might look like in a gospel-centered sort of way. I know we all have opinions about what masculinity might look like and what it might look like to be a man, but let's just ask Jesus, what does it look like to be a man? And let me just give you, I could go for a long time and mention a lot of Christ-like qualities of what it looks like to be a man. Let me just give you a couple that are off the top of my head, all right? And by top of my head, that's disingenuous. I thought about this a little bit. Let me just take you to a few points in the gospel that I think just consistently, Jesus shows up in these ways. So first one is Luke 4. If you want to, there's a Bible in front of you, or you might have brought yours. There's going to be the words in the text. But This is Luke 4. This is right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Jesus was tested in the wilderness by the enemy, and now he begins his ministry. And it says in Luke 4:14, Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Holy Spirit. Ooh, we like that word, power. And news about him spread throughout the whole countryside. He was teaching in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, just like today, like we're doing today. He went in the synagogue, and as was his custom, he stood up to read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. And unrolling it, he found the place. So he intentionally went to this text. And he said this: "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. What does it look like to be a man? The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." What does it look like to be a Christian man? Scholars will tell us that Luke put this story in here right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry because he was telling us something by this strategic placement. Luke was trying to tell us, just so you know, this is what Jesus was all about. This is not Randy and I making this up. This is biblical scholars telling us. Luke was extremely intentional about putting this sermon and this story right in the beginning of the story of Jesus in the Gospels and what Jesus was like as he walked around on planet Earth. And Luke is telling us this right here is the thesis statement for the ministry of Jesus. What does it look like to be a Christian man? I believe it looks like a Christian man stands against injustice and oppression. A Christian man stands against injustice and oppression. A Christian man walking in the way of Jesus stands for the oppressed and stands with the oppressed. A Christian man doesn't further marginalize people. A Christian man looks out at the world around them and says, "How do I bring more justice to this world?" A Christian man uses that power of the Holy Spirit that empowered Jesus in the beginning of this narrative. A Christian man uses that strength in order to bring people who are marginalized and low, seen as low in this world, up to a place of dignity and honor. A Christian man brings liberation to the world. What does it look like to be a Christian man? It doesn't look like trying to prop yourself up. It looks like trying to bring everybody else up. Because I'm secure in my place, I actually want to bring people around me up into these places. We stand against injustice and oppression as men, as Christian men. Let me keep moving because my time is limited. Next one is not Luke 4, but John 4. Just going to begin a story. Ooh, a good one in John 4. John 4, starting in verse 1, "Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees heard he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples, no big deal. So he left Judea, came back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, 'Will you give me a drink?' His disciples had gone to town to buy some food. The Samaritan woman said to him, 'You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?'" In other words, "You're not supposed to be talking to me. First of all, I'm a woman," this Samaritan woman saying. "I'm a woman, and men don't talk to women in this culture. Never. It's considered uncouth, scandalous. You don't do it. Also, she was a Samaritan woman, which means you wouldn't even, a Jewish woman wouldn't lower herself to speak to a Samaritan woman, even though they're both women. It's just, this woman is doubly marginalized. But Jesus is engaging with her. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with and that well is deep. Where can I get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself and as his sons did, also his sons and his livestock?" And Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up into eternal life." Now, the story goes on, and most of us know it. But the point I'm trying to make here with this story is that Jesus, what does a Christian man look like in the way of Jesus? In a culture in which men were told you have to hate women. In a culture in which just the patriarchy was in the water. Men and women couldn't associate. We see God showing up in the flesh as a man, and he starts engaging with women in scandalous ways. He starts honoring women in scandalous ways, makes women part of his followers in scandalous, unheard of ways. See, Christian men honor and dignify women. They don't tear women down. What does it look like to be a Christian man walking in the way of Jesus? They don't see women as their competition. They don't scapegoat women and blame women for all the things wrong with men in our culture, in our world. Here, let me just give you a little, if you think I'm being a little kind of hyperbolic or I'm going overboard, let me read you a little snippet from just to kind of pop culture evangelicalism. This is from Answers in Genesis. Many people, many, many Christians read this stuff. And it's, I'm just going to read you the introduction to this article. It's called "Rebuilding Biblical Manhood Using the Genesis Blueprints." Okay, it's going to be good. The author says this: "Yes, there is a war on biblical manhood in our culture today. Specifically, there is a war on the way God designed men to be, and it has been raging since the fall of man in Genesis 3 with recent success, especially in the West. Without question, these attacks have been fueled by the modern feminist movement, one of the fruits of secular humanism, which is an anti-God religion," it says here. "There have been many evils spawned from the feminist movement over the last generation, such as the so-called, square quotes, reproductive right to the murder of the preborn, thus allowing sexual, quote, scare quote, freedom and, scare quote, autonomy for women, and the overall defiance of the God-ordained hierarchical structure within the family, distorting biblical gender roles and distinctions." Now, how do you argue when they use those words? The overall defiance of the God-ordained hierarchical structure within the family. How do you argue with that if it's God-ordained? He says this: "I think most Christians are likely aware of these serious diseases plaguing the culture that need to be dealt with today, but one of the most obvious and yet generally unspoken consequences of the feminist movement that has totally permeated the culture is the feminization and emasculation of men." The problem with men, my man from Answers in Genesis would say, is woman, is the feminist movement. See, I want to say men who look like Jesus, what it means to be a Christian man living in operating in the way of Jesus, men don't scapegoat women. Men don't blame women. Men don't try to hold women down. Men try, real Christian men walking in the way of Jesus, empower women. Christian men walking in the way of Jesus, what it looks like to be a Christian man walking in the way of Jesus, it looks like partnering with women, not exalting women in kind of a patriarchal, pat on the head kind of you're the fairer sex kind of way, but actually in a real partnership kind of way, dignifying their humanity and dignifying their place as co-equals with us as men. Men, real men, walking in the way of Jesus, dignify and honor and empower and partner with women. I can't say it any more simple than that. And I'm going to keep moving. What does it look like to be a Christian man? Let's move next to Matthew chapter 9. Now, if you're a good Bible student and I say Matthew chapter 9, you know the story that I'm probably bringing us to. This is Matthew 9, verse 35. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in all their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into the harvest field." What does it look like to be a Christian man? I think if we're walking in the way of Jesus, it looks like being a man of compassion. What does it look like to be a Christian man? If we're walking in the way of Jesus, it looks like being moved by compassion and opening yourself to compassion. Because, see, compassion changes the way you see the people around you. Compassion changes the way you interact with the people around you and the way that you interact with the world. But, see, too many of us men, especially if we're operating and taking things in on the manosphere, are told that what it looks like to be a man is to be dominant, to be an alpha, to look strong at all times. But if you actually pay attention to how Jesus lives and operates in the Gospels, you'll find, I think, what it means to be a Christian man looks like being in touch with your emotions and feelings. See, because you can't look out at a crowd and feel compassion on them if you're not in touch with your feelings and emotions, if you're not present to what's going on inside of you. But too many boys and young men are told that what it means to be a man is just to cover all that stuff up. And the experts and the researchers will tell us that's part of the reason why men are in crisis right now, because we don't know how to deal with our feelings and our emotions and our big stuff, our big feelings. We stifle it. But what we find in Jesus is someone who's actually willing to be vulnerable. Men, to be a Christian man, looks like being willing to be vulnerable, to be moved by other people in compassion. I'm fairly certain that if Jesus was walking planet Earth today, he would be accused by the bro culture as being a beta or a soy boy. I online have been called a soy boy and a beta for standing up for women and queer people. I'm almost positive Jesus would be called a soy boy, a beta, soft, not a real man, by our culture's, Christian culture's standards. But see, Christian men are moved by compassion, are compassionate humans. It's not a weakness, it's not a fault. It's actually this beautiful part of what it means to be a human and what it means to be man, a man. Our kids need our compassion. Our spouses need our compassion. The world around us needs compassionate men. Let me give you the last one, because it's the thing that everything else stands on. And it's so simple, but I just can't not say it. This is Matthew 22. Matthew 22, Jesus being tested by the religious leaders. They're getting ready to just try to get rid of him. And in verse 34 of Matthew 22, it says this: "Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together." Now it's our turn to try to challenge Jesus. One of them, an expert in the law — that means he knows his Bible. He's an expert in the scriptures. That means this is not just a lawyer. This is an expert in the Torah. "Teacher," this expert said, this biblical scholar said, "which commandment is the greatest in the law?" And Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the rest of the law and prophets hang on these two commandments." What does it look like to be a Christian man? It looks like being a man who is moved and motivated by love. I'm at a loss for words because this is so core and central to what it looks like to be a man in our world today, I think. And there's words just cheapen it. But I want to tell you, our world, our nation, needs men who are moved by love. Our world needs young men and boys who have been discipled and raised by other men. Because you know what the statistics and researchers are saying? Even in academia, the liberals, they're saying that fathers are actually really important. And our kids, in particular our boys, need to be raised by men who love deeply. Men who are loved deeply and can receive that, and men who give that love deeply. Because what happens when you are a man who's marked by love is all the other stuff that I'm talking about and the stuff that I don't have time to mention, it just starts happening. If you're a man who's marked by love, you are just going to notice injustice and oppression where you see it, because you're moved and motivated by compassion and love. When you're a man motivated by love, you are going to want to empower and equip the women around you and to partner with them, because you no longer want to compete with them. You no longer want to scapegoat them or blame them or stand on their backs. You want to champion them because you are a man who is full of and moved and motivated by love. And love looks like preferring others over ourselves. Men, this is what it looks like to be a man. Is to put others over and above yourselves, just like Jesus who went to the cross. What does it look like to be a Christian man? It looks like being a man who's marked by and moved by and molded by and oriented by love. Our world needs more men who live in this place and are immersed in this place of love. Now let me give you just one more thing. This is not like, I could have just kind of found this in the gospel narrative, but I just want to kind of pick this out and say, in response to the statistics, this is something that I've just had in the back of my mind as I think about my boys. I have three boys who are growing up in this world, and I'm trying to figure out how to raise them to be men that look like Jesus, that look like Christian men. I want them to be men of motivated by love, and I want them to be men. I can't even look at them. Moved by compassion. Moved by the way they champion women. Moved by to stand against injustice where they find it. I want that. And what I also want for them, and I want for all of us men, this is just a little anecdotal. The researchers say men are falling out and further away from relationships. Did you hear those statistics? Let me go back and just find it and read it to you one more time here. In 1990, 55% of men said they had six or more close friends. In 2029, that number had dropped in half to 27%. The percentage of men who say they have no close friends has gone from 3% in 1990 to 15% in 2021. And for single men, that's one in five say they have no close friends. Men, move towards relationships. Besides rooting yourself in the scriptures and in the gospel and the person of Christ himself, I don't know of many things that will anchor you as men more than friendships that you actually intentionally choose to cultivate. Now, here's why I think, a couple of reasons why I think we're falling further and further out of relationships and friendships and why we're growing more and more isolated. One of the things is, can I find it? This right here. I'm just going to be old for a minute. Can you let me be old? When you have your face in a screen all day long, when you have your face in a screen all day long, all night long, when you have your face in a screen on YouTube all day long, it's really hard to be in relationship with people, like real relationships with real people that aren't on your screen. We just lived through a pandemic where our world got more and more isolated. We were following the rules by being more and more isolated, and what happened is this isolation got accelerated. It got it got this boost of steroids, and now we seem to be falling further and further into more isolation. And I'll bet you any money, 10 years from now, these numbers and statistics are gonna skyrocket because of the pandemic. Men, be vulnerable with each other. Can I say this? Initiate with one another. I have two groups of friends that are, like, in the words that the kids use, my ride or dies. I'm gone from this church on Sundays twice a year, and you can know that one of them in May, the third weekend in May every year, I'm going to be with a group of friends who would die for me. And then usually in fall, I've got another group of friends who I'll be with them one weekend per year, two groups, friend groups, because we want to orient our lives around one another. And a lot of times, guess what? I'm the one who has to initiate. I have to be the one to send the text. And I get trouble for it sometimes. I get made fun of for it by these dudes. But you know what? I don't give a rip. Because I know what happens in those times is we are better for being around each other. See, in the course of us being friends, we're starting to get old enough where real life stuff has happened. One of our friends, his marriage ended. And it felt like his life did too in some ways. Another one of our friends actually lost his wife. She died. And you know what happened? We just loved each other and showed up for each other and changed each other's lives because we were present in one another's lives. We are growing through those times. Those men, who have hit these crises in life, I can watch them because I've known them for decades now, and I can say, you are a better and different person because of these relationships and because of the way you follow after Jesus and because of the way I'm pushing you to. Because I also know I'm going to go through these crises in life, and I don't know if I'm going to make it if I don't have these men around me. Men, initiate relationship with one another. Move towards relationship. If you fall into that category of not having close friends or not having enough close friends or having those friendships drift off, be intentional. Be vulnerable. Reach out. Make the first move, whether it's in friendship or in dating, I'm going to say. Be initiators, not because this is like the alpha male way to live, but because it's the best way to live. Because we're falling away from relationships, and as we do that, we're seeing our health and humanity fall away from us as well. Orient yourself around relationships and friendships and one another. And always, always be looking not to the manosphere for what it looks like to be a man, not to the talking heads for what it looks like to be a man, not to the pastors with rips in their jeans who say, like, it looks like Mark Driscoll to be a man. It looks like Jesus. Being a man just simply looks like Jesus. It looks like standing against injustice and oppression. It looks like honoring and dignifying women. It looks like being a man of compassion and a man who lives in and is moved by and motivated by love. And it looks, because of that, it looks like a man who's willing to say, I need my friends, I need relationships, I need people. This is not rocket science, friends. But man, I hope my boys are listening. And I hope the men in this church are listening. And I hope we can actually embody a more beautiful way to show up as men and show a more beautiful kind of masculinity to the world around us. Because this is what this person named Jesus has given us. If you're able, let's stand. We're going to finish our time. Let's do one more worship song. If you can't stay, if you got to go, that's no worries at all. But we're just going to punctuate our time here with one more song, just to be able to say together and sing out together some real and true things, to remind ourselves of some things as we walk out this door. So Jesus, Father, Son, Spirit, would you empower us to live as men like you, Jesus? to ignore the noise, and to just remember who you are and who you're calling us to be. Would you move us towards one another? Would you move us towards wholeness and life and beauty and goodness and strength? Strength that brings and pulls others up alongside them. I thank you for reclaiming and reframing and reorienting what it looks like to be a man, Jesus, because of you and your masculinity and your goodness and beauty and your compassion and your love, Jesus. And so now we as one community, as a spiritual family, sing this as we go our separate ways.
Thank you again for being with us. We would love to have you join us if you are ever in the Milwaukee area, and we hope you have a healthy place to gather wherever you are from.